Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, broadcasting live from Anchorage, Alaska, and we have some information on people whose names might be familiar to you. Who are they? Well, they are lesser known giants of the 20th century. And Mr. Charles M. Aleno is my guest today, and we're going to be discussing a few of these phenomenal personalities that have had an effect on our lives on so many different levels. And the research he's done is just amazing. Hello, Mr. Aleno. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, may I call you Charles?
Well, yes, that'll be fine.
All right, great. Now, what I wanted to do, Charles, was to mention something that we were discussing before we went on the air, and that you did this compilation of information regarding some people that were well-known, but the research that you did on these lesser-known giants of the 20th century took you 5 years because you did this research as a part-time exercise. What motivated you to choose the individuals that you did, and what made you decide you wanted to put the details of information you discovered in a book?
Well, it all resulted from the first story, which is the story of I.J. Paderewski, the great Polish pianist and statesman. It was in the mid-1980s. My wife and I were on a trip to Paris that included a tour of Versailles. And while we were there, we noticed a larger-than-life reproduction of the signature pages of the treaty signed at the end of World War I that took up one gigantic wall in the palace. And you could easily recognize the names of some of the famous statesmen of the day, including Clemenceau and Lloyd George. But right in the midst of them was a beautifully scripted I.J. Paderewski. And I thought, now that's amazing to me, because when I was a kid, my parents gave me piano lessons, and my mother would always say to me, if you practice every day, you'll grow up to play like Paderewski. So I just knew of him as a great pianist. And I thought to myself, now why would a piano player have signed the Versailles Treaty? So that motivated me to find out about him. And of course, what happened was he was very politically active in the interest of Polish freedom. At the end of World War I, he was swept into office as prime minister. And so he actually had two absolutely remarkable lives all in one life. And it made me think there must be others, people who did absolutely amazing things in their lifetimes and who were very famous while living, but soon forgotten. And so what I tried to do is to come up with a group of them whose lives overlapped and spanned the 20th century. That way, the history of the great American century would act as a backdrop to the stories.
You have a story in your book about Paderewski that I think is just absolutely amazing, and it had to do with a Steinway piano. Would you share that with us?
Well, the Steinway wound up being Paderewski's American sponsor. Before the year 1900, he began American tours, and Steinway essentially made all the arrangements, arranged for him to have a private railroad car, and provided him with the pianos, of course, because it was great promotion for their product.
Sure.
But on one occasion, the piano had been re-regulated by a technician, and not in the manner that Paderewski was used to. And so when he began with a brilliant, virtuosic piece of music, he wound up injuring his hand. He broke a couple tendons, and he actually had to teach himself on the fly to play with only four fingers. So that was quite an achievement that he managed to get through that concert tour with a serious injury to his hand.
And also, there was a very special story that you had inserted regarding him and Herbert Hoover and how they met at one time, and it came full circle, and there was a special series of circumstances that evolved between these two men. Tell us that story.
Well, I think it's a very heartwarming story. It turns out that on one of his early American tours, when he arrived in California, he was approached by two college students who were working their way through Stanford, and they promised him a significant fee if he would agree to play a recital in San Jose, where they had arranged to rent a concert hall. So kind of on a lark, he went along with it. But unfortunately, they didn't have the experience to carry it off, and they didn't collect enough in ticket sales. So they were crestfallen, and they offered Paderewski all the money they had plus a promissory note. He tore up the note and gave them the money back and said, first, what you do is pay all the bills and then keep a share for your hard work and just send me whatever was left. So he really let them off the hook, and they were very grateful to him. But, you know, it was one of those things. He didn't really give it much thought for years to come. But then when he was premier of Poland at the end of World War One, there was a terrible humanitarian crisis of starvation because of the war. And the only reason it was averted was because of the American Food Mission for Europe that saved all of the Polish countrymen. And Paderewski went to the head of the mission, who was future President Herbert Hoover, and said to him, I could never repay you. And Hoover had to remind him that he had been one of those two Stanford men all those years earlier. And so he said he was happy that at last he could repay that benevolence. And it really was, I thought, a very heartwarming story.
It's a phenomenal story, and it just shows what goes around comes around.
I
want my audience, Charles, to know about you. You're an attorney that has had more than 30 years of experience in estate, trust, tax, and financial planning and practice. So that taught you how to do research, I'm sure. And you're currently the first vice president and director of financial planning for the Glenmead Trust Company and the investment manager of the Pew Charitable Trust. And you had graduated from Rutgers University, cum laude, and from the Seton Hall University of Law and from New York University. And you are yourself an amateur pianist and a private pilot. And you and your family reside in New Jersey. You had to have a lot of discipline to do the research, but there is one person in here that really grabbed my attention. Not that each and every one of the people that you wrote about wasn't interesting, but I thought this has an effect on the lives of this man. What he did has an effect on the lives of millions of people, even today, because of the legacy that he left. But boy, have time changed. And I'm talking about Luigi Giannini.
Yeah.
And this is a man that I just, you know, I when I read the story, I thought his standards, his integrity, everything that just was demonstrative, or I should, let me rephrase that, that was demonstrated by him, would be that kind of standard that I think a lot of people in the banking industry should follow today. That's Donna's comments there. But this is a man, what a story. He's Italian, and he endured extreme prejudice, but that didn't stop him. And he seemed to come in with a sense for business. Give us a little bit of background on Giannini.
Well, he was started a neighborhood bank to serve the needs of immigrant working families in San Francisco in 1903. And that, at the time, was a revolutionary idea. Other banks were not in the least interested in the accounts of common people. As a matter of fact, most of them wouldn't let you have an account unless you had a substantial amount of money. Giannini was willing to open a one-penny savings account, and so his bank grew pretty rapidly. Of course, only 3 years later, there was the horrible tragedy of the earthquake and fire in San Francisco. Everything was destroyed. Giannini actually dug through the rubble and recovered the bank's gold and records, spirited it out of town to protect it, and in just a few days set up a temporary office on the wharf of San Francisco and began making loans on a handshake to get the process of recovery started. It was an absolutely wonderful story, and he was credited with being one of the greatest contributors to the beginning of the recovery of San Francisco. And that just led to a whole life of amazing achievement. Of course, his bank was growing at the time of the Great Depression. It weathered the storm. And in the midst of it, when everybody was totally panicked, here's Giannini putting up all of the money for the bonds needed to pay for the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge. His bank, his dream of his lifetime, was coast-to-coast banking, but he encountered terrific resistance from both the Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt administrations so that it couldn't be achieved in his lifetime. But I think when he died at the end of the 1940s, he knew that the way was clear and that eventually it would take place. So he is a great innovator, the great story of an immigrant son who became extremely successful. And of course, my grandfather was an immigrant from Italy to America around the year 1900. So in many ways, it has special meaning for me. And I remember in particular a story when Giannini was really becoming famous. His face was on the cover of Time magazine and so forth. There was a man on the street interview in San Francisco where the reporter asked an Italian man what he thought of that banker. And he said, "Well, before Giannini, I was a Dago. Now I am an American." So that's the impact he had on people in my grandparents' and parents' generation.
Yes, and not only that, but what you uncovered in your research was just incredible about this man, because this man actually was the founder of the Bank of America as we know it today. And when you were going through your research and you found the obstacles that he had encountered from those people in the industry, and how J.P. Morgan, who founded the Federal Reserve, he and some colleagues, tried to destroy him, and he did not know that J.P. Morgan was working against him, but he beat him, and he actually was able to survive that. It's just incredible. And at the time, and this is in 1926, so those of you listening, you have to remember the numbers I'm giving you, you might double or triple or quadruple in value today. He had $750 million in assets, and at the time in 1926, he had 276 branches. Now, at that time, it was called the Bank of Italy.
That's
and
right.
he was just so big, but people were out to destroy him, especially J.P. Morgan. Tell us how he found out what J.P. Morgan was up to.
Well, it was through a series of events that he finally discovered Morgan was working in league with a couple of Wall Street bankers that he had hired in hopes of bringing what was to become Bank of America to the next level. And partly through private investigators, he learned that they were plotting to completely liquidate the company. So he rose to the occasion. He announced a proxy fight, which he ultimately won, and took back control of the company that he had turned over to these other bankers, and just put the thing back on the right course and headed in the right direction. All of this in the midst of the Great Depression. It was just an inspiration.
Yes, it was a June stock raid.
That's right.
As you say it in the book. So, ladies and gentlemen, when you think about the stuff that's going on today, it's always good to ask, who's behind the money? Who's behind, really, a lot of decisions? And that's something that often isn't uncovered for many years later. How was it that you were able to discover this conspiracy? Isn't that a cool word to use? That was put up against him. Where did you find the records on this? I would imagine
there's plenty of information published on Giannini. My primary reference source was an absolutely wonderful biography by a professor of history at the University of California, Felice Bonadio, entitled A.P. Giannini, Banker of America. And much of the material was found there. And then I cobbled together bits and pieces from other sources, mostly through the internet and just following threads here and there. But there was plenty of material to work with. No lack of it at all.
Well, that is fabulous. And then there was the process in the banking. Now, here is a man that really was savvy. He had retired from his positioning. And then there were four men. In fact, two of them were nephews of the founder of Wells Fargo, Marco and Irving Hellman, Edward Nolan, who was the president of Merchants, and a real estate investor named Charles R. Bell. These four people, you say in your book, and I'll quote exactly, were victims of the same foolishness by which many have been caught up before and since. They overextended to take advantage of real estate opportunities that seemed destined to bring them unimaginable fortunes in the boom days of the 1920s. And, of course, that went down really bad, and they resorted to elaborate schemes of embezzlement, deception, and cover-up that ultimately delivered a near-fatal blow to the company Transamerica. And their losses were $35 million, and you can compound that I don't know how many times. Look at what we've just gone through today in today's world. My goodness, doesn't history repeat itself over and over again? But he managed to come out of it. He managed to really pull things out, and he was so loved. When he passed away, there were so many that remembered what this man had done for them. And difficult, difficult times. And again, he represented a standard. It's fascinating, fascinating reading. And he said, you say in here, he left for his son these words, administer this trust generously and nobly, remembering always human suffering like St. Francis of Assisi, do good. Do not merely theorize about goodness. Now, his estate wasn't a real large one that he left, but he said that was left was to be given away to charities and the balance to a foundation that he had established while he was living. So he really had purpose his whole life.
Well, Giannini felt that it was wrong to become a millionaire. And when he got his own personal fortune near $1 million, he gave a lot of it away so he'd be under that. He turned down bonuses in order to plow more money back into the company. He saw to it that his children were provided for. His wife had predeceased him, but he did leave whatever was left to charity. And there is actually a foundation still in existence that at this point is used to support a school named for him. It's just really too bad that not more people remember his story, because it is a tremendous inspiration. And I have to tell you, one thing you mentioned earlier, that these are all people who were very famous, and they were. But what's fascinating to me is that I'm finding that virtually no person who's of high school or college age or to about their mid to late 20s has ever heard the names of any of these people.
Well, that's not really a surprise. If you think of each generation that has had their giants, every generation has those individuals that generation will remember. And in school today, history is not something that's emphasized. Years ago, it was important. In fact, you were encouraged as a student, do research on people. Go and find out about different information. At least when I was in school, that's the way it was. But it's not being so emphasized at this time. Even in colleges, unless that is your subject of choice. And I think history is important. When I read the story about Giannini, I thought, this is a statement about how important integrity is and how quickly it can be totally destroyed by those who are unscrupulous. And it's not a new story. Look at Madoff. Look at all of the people that have suffered because of him. We always have a Ponzi somewhere.
That's right.
And so I think it's great. You need to know about the Ponzi's, but you need to know about people like you've written about in your book, the lesser-known giants of the 20th century. And I think Giannini, and this is my bias, is very significant because this man's word was his honor. and he stood behind those people that he believed in. And I think that this is something that we really need to emphasize. We need to teach our younger generations about individuals that did have integrity. We don't have to expect that everybody that's in politics, or we shouldn't have to, or anybody that's in this profession or that profession, gee, they're crooks. That's just what you expect. That's not what you want to do. And I think that he represents a standard that is just outstanding. Let's talk about two men, Max Schelming and Joe Lewis. Now, I didn't know a thing about Max. Joe Lewis, I can remember hearing about when I was a little girl. My dad was really someone that enjoyed that kind of activity, like sports. But I didn't know anything about this other boxer. Now, for those who are listening who are not familiar with Joe Lewis or Max Schelming, we're going to tell you about two men. And this is boxing we're talking about. We're going into sports. We're going to hear the name of Jack Dempsey. We're going to hear, you know, all kinds of names that maybe will touch the memory banks of some of you. Tell us, Charles, about these two men.
Well, they both came from very humble beginnings, very poor families. Joe Lewis grew up in Alabama, but his family had to flee to Chicago to escape threats from the Ku Klux Klan. And he was one who was not a particularly good student, but had great talent in the sport of boxing, and so he eventually became heavyweight champion of the year. Schmeling grew up in post-World War I Germany, also from very humble beginnings. He just loved the sport of boxing from the first time he saw a movie of a heavyweight bout between Jack Dempsey and a French fighter named Georges Carpentier. He became transfixed by it, went back to see the movie over and over again, and then that became his career as well. Now, in the 1930s, both Lewis and Schmeling were heavyweight contenders, potential champions, and they both had an enormous following of fans. Joe Lewis, of course, drew the attention of the black community because of the fact that here was a star of national proportions who was a black man. The only other black heavyweight champion had been a guy by the name of Jack Johnson, who was a notorious figure and had been finally wound up in prison, and just a terrible story. But here's this clean-cut young man who's full of respect and just a model of a sports champion. And then you had Schmeling, who coincidentally bore a striking resemblance to Jack Dempsey. And he was immediately accepted in America, not only by the German-American community, but across the board. He was just the kind of person that everybody seemed to like as soon as they met him. So they were both very popular. They had two fights. The first one took place in 1936, and Schmeling won by a knockout. That was the only time Joe Lewis was ever knocked out in his fighting career, except for his very last fight, when he lost to Rocky Marciano. But here was Schmeling, the victor of the first fight, and he was accepted as a great champion at that time. But 2 years later, the 2 years that passed, everything in the world changed. During those 2 years, German bombers had devastated the Spanish city of Guernica during the First World the Spanish-American War, and Germany had annexed Austria and was threatening Czechoslovakia. So during those 2 years, the Germans went from an annoyance that people didn't want to think about to an international pariah, and World War II was obvious was going to take place. Unfortunately for Schmeling, he was portrayed as the champion of the Nazis, although he was not a Nazi or a Nazi sympathizer. And Joe Lewis, whether he liked it or not, was cast in the role of the hero of the Allied powers. So the second fight, which was billed as the fight of the century, that took place in June 1938 in Yankee Stadium, was an allegory for the impending battles of World War II. Unfortunately for Schmeling, he only lasted 2 minutes and 4 seconds. He was nearly killed by Lewis. He suffered a broken vertebrae, among other injuries, and so he was devastated. When he returned to Germany, the Nazis would have nothing to do with him because he had lost, and they banned his name from the newspaper. It was against the law to print his name in the newspaper. He was forced to join the paratroopers and nearly killed in the German invasion of Crete. But somehow he survived. And after the war, a former New York State banking boxing commissioner, who had always liked Schmeling, looked him up, came to Germany and found him. That was James Aloysius Farley. And Farley at that time had left government service and was working as chief of international development for Coca-Cola. He offered Schmeling the franchise for Germany and made him a decamillionaire. Schmeling, for the rest of his life, gave much of the money away through philanthropy. And as a matter of fact, a few years later, when Joe Lewis died broke, Max Schmeling helped to pay for his funeral.
It was a wonderful relationship of these two men. They had no animosity towards each other, and Joe Lewis fell on very, very hard times because he really was not very good with money. And there was a wonderful woman by the name of Martha that became his wife and really looked out for him. But I was fascinated to find out that Joe Lewis actually ended up being in a respectable positioning in Las Vegas, Glitter City, where he was able to live a number of years, being able to have the respect and the opportunity to still be a productive person, because his life pretty much, after boxing, there wasn't a whole lot available to him.
That's true.
So that's amazing. Now, you've also written about women. You've got Margaret Chase Smith, and this was a woman that just, you've got a couple of women in here. She's just an amazing gal. I know we don't have a whole bunch of time left, but tell us about Margaret Chase Smith and why you chose Margaret.
Well, I just thought she was one of the bravest women of the 20th century. Elected to Congress in 1940 when her husband died, but reelected 4 times in her own right, and then promoted by the voters of Maine to the Senate, where she served until 1972. In 1964, her name was placed in nomination for the office of President of the United States, the first time that happened at the National Convention of a major party, the Republican Party. And most important, in 1950, Margaret Chase Smith was the only member of the United States Senate who showed the courage to stand in vocal opposition to the tactics of Senator Joseph McCarthy. So she is really, and you know, I can't help but thinking, imagine the parallels. That was a very brave act. What do we have today? Another woman senator from the same state of Maine, Olympia Snow, who appears to be the only Republican senator to support national health care reform. There must be something about Maine that does that.
maybe it's in the water. I don't know.
I don't know.
But there's I think people of Maine are pretty independent, and I think that there's a lot going on there. But there is so much in your book, Giants, Lesser Known Giants of the 20th Century, that when I went through it and I read it, and there's a man in here, Paul Winchell, that I just think is incredible. He was a genius. There are other individuals that you have written about. I think you've just done a phenomenal, phenomenal job. And it really makes it a very important point, I think, and that is one person can make a difference. And fame, well, that's a fleeting thing. But when you can leave your mark in a way that can make this world a better place, and each of these people that you have written about have done exactly that. Charles, your website is charlesolino.com, and that's charlesaulino.com. We have about a minute left here. What would you like to leave my listeners with as a thought?
Well, I would just like to say that if you're interested in this book, the best thing you can do is promote it among young people who are the least likely to have heard anything about these heroes and the most likely to draw inspiration from their wonderful stories.
Thank you, Charles. It's been absolutely a delight having you as a guest today. Lesser-known giants of the 20th century, I learned quite a bit. Perhaps you would, too. It doesn't hurt to go back into the past because, just like with Giannini, you can learn that these mistakes are repeated over and over again unless we're wise enough to prevent them by standing on the shoulders of those that have gone before us and using their wisdom. This is Donna Sebo. Go to charlesolino.com. Find out more about these wonderful people. And again, Charles, thank you for being my guest. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hello, and welcome back. Well, telephone lines are open, and if you'd like to chat with me, not a problem. All you have to do is pick up your telephone and call 888-815-9756, and I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Again, that's 888-815-9756. If you're a first-time listener and you would like to call and you say, gee, what's this all about, Donna? Well, I'm doing readings on the air. And if you have a question about a dream that you'd like interpreted or something of that nature, I'm happy to assist you with that, too. And again, all I need from you is your first name or initial. Then I also like to know where you're calling from. And then after that, just relax and let me tell you what I perceive. Remember, I'm an information resource. And so I'm right here on the air live with you, even though it's coming from Anchorage, Alaska. Now, I'll tell you what. The weather here is breathtakingly gorgeous. And if you think I work for the Alaska Visitors Bureau, you're sadly mistaken. I'd love to, but I don't. It is just beautiful. I'm looking out over the Cook Inlet, and yeah, there's no ice in it, but I'll tell you what, it's coming in. We can feel the change in the weather, in the temperatures, but the sun's out, the sky is blue, and it is absolutely magnificent. It is a perfect fall day. The trees are changing color very quickly now, and they'll be dropping their leaves soon. But they have been blessed with an unusually gorgeous, gorgeous fall. In today's world, we are being forced by necessity and almost a sense of urgency to become more aware of what we do. There are absolutely millions and millions of vehicles that are being utilized today, and there are pressures being put on saying we've got to have better utilization of energy. What can we do to get rid of the old way of doing things? Well, it's pretty hard to break through a system that has been in place for a long time, and ingenuity has always been around. Apparently, in the early 1900s, someone did come up with an engine that would run on water, but who knows what happened to that? That disappeared. Well, right now, at this time, there are federal rules that have been proposed. In fact, they were proposed this past May that would require passenger vehicles here in the U.S. to achieve an average of 35.5 miles per gallon by 2016, 39 miles per gallon for cars and 30 miles per gallon for light trucks. Now, that would be up from today's standard, right? My feeling is they could do a heck of a lot better than that. Why they are not pushing for that, I don't know. And manufacturers are fearing that this proposal will cost billions of dollars to perfect electric and hybrid technologies in time to meet the requirements. But there have been people that have been working with new concepts that suggest there might be ways to coax a lot more efficiency from old, tried, and true internal combustion engines. Yes, they think they can make what we've already got work better. It's really tough to break that paradigm. So it has not changed. The engine, basic engine design, the gasoline engine, hasn't changed very much in over 100 years. Now, what does it do? There's a piston that draws a mixture of air and fuel into a cylinder, compresses it, a spark plug ignites the mixture, and the explosion pushes a piston, rotating a crankshaft to turn the wheels. Waste products, as we know, go out the exhaust valve, and it's done over and over again, millions and millions of times. Well, they have done something like direct fuel injection and variable valve timing. Little things like that have improved, but there are needs for bigger changes. So these are some of the ideas that have come up. Micro machines. Have you heard of them? Well, there's a Michigan-based EcoMotors International. They're out to shrink the engine, but make the power stay. Now, economy cars typically have four-cylinder engines with a four-stroke cycle. Now, EcoMotors apparently has designed an unusual two-stroke diesel system consisting of a pair of two-cylinder modules. Under normal conditions, only one module runs at a time. The engine is two-thirds the size of a modern high-mileage turbo diesel system. EcoMotors claims it is 50% more fuel efficient, and the company is also developing a 70-mile-per-gallon gasoline system that it hopes to demonstrate by 2010. They're also trying to get rid of idling. And they feel that running an engine while waiting for a traffic light to turn green wastes fuel. Start-stop engines. Yep, that's what somebody else is working on. They switch off a car when it is stationary for more than a second or two. Then a battery kicks in to keep the radio and heater going. As soon as the driver hits the accelerator or the clutch, the engine restarts. Now, hybrid cars already do it, but manufacturers such as BMW and Mazda are integrating the concept into non-hybrid engines. Spark plugs. Guess what they're thinking of doing? Getting rid of them. The spark plug that typically ignites fuel might be replaced by a more efficient laser. The University of Liverpool in England, their researchers are working on developing a laser ignition system, and they've begun testing it in internal combustion engines in the lab. They feel that the laser ignition system would use less power and fuel, have lower pollutant emissions, and improve performance when the engine is cold. There are so many things that people are working on. And I still say that maybe We just need to think really outside the box. There may be ways of using fuel or developing a fuel that completely will eliminate what we've already got. That is not something people want to consider because of the industries that are already in place. But if you think about electricity, you think about major changes that have evolved through the centuries, they usually have been very, very disruptive technologies. Fortunately for the whales, we found other forms of fuel that we could use to light our way in life, and that was electricity. We have so many things that we need to look at and be unafraid of changing. It's not easy, especially if you're in an industry that has become so well established, you say, what are we going to do? Well, those companies that are aware that these changes are coming are adapting. It's not unlike life. When things flip-flop on us, we usually have to become quite creative. We have to realize that we can't do things the same way that we've done before. I think someone said that's the definition of stupidity. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, especially if you keep getting in deeper and deeper and deeper in a negative way. So these are just some things that people are working on relative to the engine. And you know what? We can even do better than this. There is no reason for us to be unable to move forward, but we have to have the courage to do it. So if you are inventive and you have something that is going to improve this life in any way, go for it. Remember, demonstrate it, put it out in the marketplace, and let it be what people can see as useful. People will adapt. Look at technology. Look at what's happened with the computers. Well, we can do even better. Solar is changing. So many things are improving in life because people are saying we can do it better. But there's always that curve, being able to get it out into the market and being able to make it something that's economical where people can afford it. But hey, that's what something called ingenuity is all about. Go for it so that you know that you can make a difference. And support those people that are those idea people. Don't be afraid to check out conventions or read magazines. Open up your world. Look at all of these different variables. Now, when we were talking about the lesser-known giants of the 20th century, these were people that stepped outside of the paradigms. They were willing to take risks. They had a lot of things working against them. Look at the people that founded this country. Look at Lewis and Clark. They had to travel all across the country. They didn't have any 7-Elevens. They had to get their own food. They went through a lot of hardship. But they had to have an objective in front of them. And I don't know of anyone today that if they're going to go for life's experiences and they're going to go for what they really believe in, they also have those times of trial and tribulation. There's no such thing as a free lunch in life. I don't care what anybody says. So just realize you've got a lot to offer. Whoever you are, wherever you are, you have something special. You may never have your face on the front of Time magazine or be written up in the Wall Street Journal. That doesn't matter. What matters is that you give the very best of who you are and what your talents are, and that you be willing to learn and be open to new ideas and new concepts. And don't be afraid of change, because change doesn't have to be your enemy. It can be your friend, but you may have to do things a little differently. I had some interesting information cross my desk about computer hacking. If that doesn't make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, I don't know what will. That is absolutely our worst nightmare when it comes to technology. There are always those people out there that feel like this is what they should do. And sometimes, you will hear many times, people say, gee, if they put that much energy into development of new ideas and concepts, think of the things that they could do in life. Well, we're always going to have the hackers of one type or another. Do you know where the word hacker came from? It meant one who makes furniture with an axe. That's right. That's where the word originated from. And because of that very basis, It then evolved into meaning someone who takes pleasure in an unconventional solution to a technical obstacle. That's the accurate definition in today's world. Isn't it fascinating how words can change meaning? Now, it actually, hacking, well, I think we're going to take a break, and I'll share some information with you about computer hacking that might be of interest. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat today, 888-815-9756. I'm broadcasting from Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm happy to chat with you if you'd like to chat with me. We'll be right back after this.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to share with you the fact that for those of you in the state of Washington, I am going to be doing an appearance on November 21st for the Dickens Festival, and I'll be appearing at the King's Bookstore. Now, the Dickens Festival in Tacoma, Washington is an annual event. It's a great way to prepare for the holidays, and it's family-oriented totally. And I'm going to be doing many consultations at King's Bookstore from 12 noon on Saturday, November 21st, until the 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you want to, come on by, say hello. And if you'd like to get more information regarding this wonderful event, for those of you listening in the state of Washington, then all you need to do is to call my office if you want, 800-872-8852. Also, you can go to their website. Go to the Dickens Festival, Tacoma, Washington, and you'll find all of the event activities listed there, the contests and everything else. Part of the proceeds from my appearance will be going towards the charity that the event is going to be supporting. Now, if you want to give me a call while I'm on air, 888-815-9756 is the telephone number. And quick like a bunny, I want to say that on Monday, and this is not up on my website, but because this was just booked in, but Russell Serra is going to be my guest, and we're going to be talking about wolves. Now, he's written a novel that's based on truth about wolves, and it is fascinating, and it is absolutely an amazing read. It's called Cry, Wolf, Cry. So I invite you to tell your friends, if you love wolves like I do, then you're going to find this fascinating conversation. Tocotrienols, have you ever heard that word? Well, it's related to vitamin E. It's vitamin E beyond what we have become aware of. Dr. Barry Tan is going to be my guest. He is a researcher that has worked with this, and its purpose for wellness, fighting breast cancer and tumors of all kinds. It is absolutely mesmerizing information. So I'm looking forward to having him as a guest. And then dream job. Do you have one? Well, Sue Frederick says, I see your dream job. And she's going to be talking to us about how you can go after that, achieve what you want. The Secret Code of Success by Noah St. John is absolutely wonderful. It is a tool that I think should be handed to every high school graduate. Also, I think anyone that's looking to change careers, it is a wonderful book. And then Dr. David Clark is going to be my guest a week from today. His book is titled, They Can't Find Anything Wrong. This is a very insightful, compassionate physician that views certain things much differently than most physicians that you have met. I know you will enjoy him. So we just have tremendous lineup. Also, we're going to be talking about natural alternatives to vaccination. We're going to be into so many different topics this month. I hope you will tell your friends and join us right here at BBS. Now, before I went on the break, I was talking about hacking. Well, there's quite a bit of history about hacking. I was aware of hacking. I think anybody that's ever owned a computer, we've all heard horrible, horrible stories. But I didn't realize that it actually began. Computer hacking was born, so to speak, in the late 1950s. And you know where? Try MIT. That's right. There was an MIT Tech Model Railroad Club, and these people, just brilliant people, were so interested in electric switching, they decided they were going to prepare punch cards to control an IBM 704 mainframe. Now, these machines filled rooms, filled buildings. I mean, when you look at the old history of computers, you're just amazed that they were able to get done what they got done. I mean, we've got more in our cell phones than sometimes some of these buildings had with all of their machines. It's just amazing the progress since the 1950s. Well, one of the early programs, they just worked with it, and they said on the mainframe's console, they designed something that made it look like there was a ball zipping from left to right and then right to left with the flip of a switch. Well, out of that came computer ping pong. And then by the early 1970s, there was a hacker that came to be known by the term Captain Crunch. Actually, it was Cap'n, C-A-P-N, Crunch. And what he did, he had a toy whistle he had developed to match the 2600 hertz tone used by AT&T's long-distance switching system. And he then had access to call routing, and that ended up putting him in jail. Now, the Apple founders, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, were making and selling blue boxes, which were the electronic versions of the whistle that Mr. Draper had invented, and they ended up, Wozniak crank-called the Pope's residence in Vatican City, and he pretended to be Henry Kissinger. Gutsy. Absolutely. He also ended up, or I would say hacking ended up going to Hollywood. And have you ever seen the movie War Games? If you haven't, it's a must-see. It's absolutely fascinating. That was done in 1983, and there's just all kinds of things that were portrayed in that movie that actually did happen. And in 1983, there were six Milwaukee teens that mimicked what went on in that movie, and they hacked into the Los Alamos National Lab. They worked on nuclear weapons at the time. So this has been going on and on and on. In 88, there was a Robert T. Morris who created what we call a worm, or a self-replicating program, and it reproduced so well that it led to a multi-million dollar mess. And he ended up being convicted and sent to prison, and it was under one of the first laws for computer fraud and abuse. Well, guess what? Even though Morris did that and was put into a position of being held accountable, he is now researching computer science at, we're coming full circle, MIT. Fascinating stuff. We have a caller here just before we're going to be closing out. Hi, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
This is Wendy in West Virginia.
Hi, Wendy. Where in West Virginia?
It's by Kaiser, West Virginia. It's an upper eastern panhandle.
Oh, wow. Well, welcome to the show, Wendy. Now, by the way, we only have Do you have one fast question, hon? I wish you'd call me back next week, but let's get a question in at least because we're almost out of
time.
Well,
I want to give you kudos, and if that's all we get, that's fine.
Sure.
I called you a couple years ago, and you said I'd have a rocky but good European trip, which was true. And I called you a year ago about a new program I was going to go in, a therapy program with the VA, and you said that'd be great, but you also saw me working there. And I didn't get it at all, but I was just offered a job.
Congratulations!
So, yes.
Well, my goodness.
To one more expert.
Well, I so appreciate you calling in, Wendy. I wish you'd called in a little earlier, dear, because we're out of time.
Well, I tried to, but my home phone is real staticky. I guess we're having some problems with the line. But I just wanted to get in.
Well, thanks so much.
I wanted to let your other listeners know how accurate you are.
Well, thank you. You're so sweet. We are out of time. Wendy, call me back one day next week if you can, and make it in earlier in the show. Okay, dear? I got to go.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's so sweet of her to call in. I know sometimes you have phone problems. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I absolutely love doing this work, and I love sharing information with you. Have a great life. Have an absolutely fabulous and safe weekend, and we'll be back here talking about wolves on Monday. This is Donna Sebo broadcasting live from Anchorage, Alaska. Bye for now. Next stop, home turf. Talk to you from there on Monday. Bye.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.